The Troy Murphy Show, 7pm Thursdays on the Sutherland Shire's 2SSR 99.7 FM.
Don't let his age fool you, or the fact that he's still in high school. Our next guest is a standout speaker and authority on nuclear energy as he leads an online campaign through his website nuclearforaustralia.com in advocating for the ban on nuclear energy to be lifted and for the conversation for nuclear energy to be part of the energy mix for the next generation. As we say each week here on the show, it's where we get experts in to explain the serious stuff so we all understand it better. Joining us now is someone who I have much admiration for. We've seen him on national TV and radio speaking about his cause, and now he joins us on TTMS. William Shackle, welcome, my friend.
Thank you very much, Troy, for having me on.
My pleasure. I am so excited to speak with you, William. I saw you when you first hit the scene, and you've been on TV show and radio shows since, and I'm so excited to get you on. But, William, as with any good interview, let's find out your backstory. What do they say with the hero world? Your founding story. How did you get into learning about nuclear energy and then advocating for it as a reliable alternative for baseload power?
Well, good question, because not many young people are even told about nuclear energy when they go to school. With the ban in place today, it's simply irrelevant. So I think it was it was not very likely that I was going to hear anything about nuclear energy in school, but I did hear about it, and I first learned of nuclear energy doing a few school projects. I think it was back in grade 6, looked at it again in grade 10, and it seriously intrigued me, the topic, because I looked at what nuclear energy was able to deliver around the world, and it didn't make sense for me, Australia, keeping the prohibition in place. So last year, I decided around the school holidays, I had some time to burn, to, you know, look into the issue. I talked to experts, I read up on it, looked at the government's reports and all these academic papers, and I came to the conclusion that the ban on nuclear energy should at very least be lifted, and we should have all options on the table, and in doing that, consider the potential nuclear energy could have in addressing the climate and energy crisis. And that's then led me to found the first youth-led campaign for nuclear energy in Australia, Nuclear for Australia. And I did some stuff on social media. Like you said, I did some engage with media. I'm working with other young people to share facts and information and to provide a platform to experts who often don't get their voices heard on this issue. So at least we can have a debate around the potential and the benefits of nuclear energy.
Now, William, here in the Sutherland Shire where we broadcast, we are known for having a nuclear facility in our backyard. I have long argued that the Shire should stand tall and proud and be seen to set example for the rest of the country as a community who lives side by side with nuclear whilst having some of the country's most pristine national parks, the cleanest waterways, and of course our beautiful beaches in Cronulla. And we have no three-eyed fish or weird uncles with two heads. Now, despite living next to a nuclear facility, I did poll the residents of the Shire and found that 68% were in favour of nuclear power being added to the energy mix alongside renewables, and only 32% said no. That's changed over the years. What are your findings of the people who you talk to in your travels?
Well, it's quite clear, poll after poll, including, you know, the one that you've just explained to me, shows that Australians support nuclear energy, whether it be Compass polling that was released in May of this year, which showed that 70% of Australians wanted nuclear energy in order to reach our energy security and emissions targets. Only 18% of people, actually, according to that poll, identify as anti-nuclear. And, you know, there's other polls such as by the Lowley Institute. Even Q&A recently did a poll where 20,000 of their audience members were polled, and that found that 63% not only wanted nuclear energy to be legalised, but nuclear reactors to be built. So I think Australians are coming on board to the idea of nuclear energy. And look, I think I'd just like to touch on, you know, the work at Lucas Heights, if I may, that you just brought up at the start of your question. Look, I live in Brisbane, but I recently got to visit Lucas Heights, and I think it's a great example of how Australia would be able to be a pioneer in the civil nuclear power industry around the world, and would it be able to set a positive example of how to manage and how to succeed with the use of nuclear energy. Because ANSTO, the work that they're doing, I visited recently their facility at Lucas Heights. I was astounded, you know, by the fact that there's over 400 PhDs at ANSTO. They're at the cutting edge of research, including on waste management with their SynRock innovation. It's quite astounding, and it's a huge asset that we have in Australia, the ANSTO facility and the knowledge which is held there. And I think that given that I know the energy minister says that we'd be starting from scratch and we don't have the knowledge and expertise, but I think that goes to prove that we do, and we do have the expertise to be able to manage it properly. And I guess that's thanks to your Shire and the brilliant work that's done there.
We have some of the best nuclear science in the world in this country, and we are
indeed
crazy to not go to them and ask them questions or rely on their expertise to help us get to a cleaner future. Now, William, let's look at nuclear power and look at it a bit deeper. It appears that what is on the table for us as a solution are what are known as small modular reactors and micro modular reactors. Now, as I talk, I'm even glazing over going, what is that? Can you explain to a layman like myself what small modular reactors and micro modular reactors are?
Well, I think their name sort of gives it away, but basically small modular reactors and micro reactors, they're not this new technology. It's not some... Well, in many cases, they incorporate some new technologies, but they basically take the larger reactors, which have been proven to be successful around the world from companies such as Westinghouse, General Electric, Rolls-Royce, etc., and they condense it into a smaller package. The thought there is that these small modular reactors are optimized so that they can be mass-produced in factories to bring down the costs, and also, because they're being mass-produced, that avoids some of the cost and time which currently is impacting on large-scale nuclear reactors around the world with, you know, regulatory approvals, because each time you create a new large reactor today, you need to go through a different a regulatory process for each one, and that takes a lot of time, it costs a lot of money, and that's been plaguing the nuclear energy industry recently. So the logic behind small modular reactors is you can do the design once, it's a smaller package, you can easily transport it, you only have to go through the design process and the regulatory process once to avoid those costs. It can be mass produced, and the impact of that is it means that nuclear reactors take less time to be constructed and are more cost effective because you've got that economies of scale. So, look, it's interesting, and there's quite a few companies currently developing small modular reactors. I'd encourage your audience to look at, you know, what companies like NuScale are doing, TerraPower, which is being funded by Bill Gates, the Rolls-Royce small modular reactors. There are all these options that Australia could look at, and they're going to be constructed, and they're currently being constructed, and they should be completed very shortly.
Is it my...
So there's something that Australia should consider.
Yeah. Now, is it my understanding that these smaller nuclear reactors are effectively plug and play with the Australian grid system? So,
yeah,
I use the plug and play as a gaming metaphor for so most people my generation and probably your generation and probably older generations too can understand, but we essentially can just plop them anywhere and then plug them into the system we already have.
Look, what I'd first say is with all these questions, I'm obviously 17-year-old. I'm no expert, so I'd encourage people to do their own research on these things to corroborate what I'm saying. But from my understanding and talking to experts who are very knowledgeable in this field, it is a plug-and-play system because it's a like alternative to the current fossil fuel infrastructure we have. Nuclear energy is a form of baseload power, which means it's reliable, and it means it. And as a result of that, it keeps the lights on, and we're going to be experiencing reliability issues, as many experts, including, you know, AEMO, is predicting into the future, and that puts at risk the lights going out. So the thoughts with small modular reactors is the current sites where coal-fired power stations are, they would be ideal to just place a small modular reactor there. You can import it, very easily ship it. All we would need to do is pour really the concrete foundation and then plop it on top. It's as simple as that. And that would work that way. And the, yes, go on.
I was going to say, I want you to continue with it, that what your line of thought there. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I just want to jump in and say, William, never play down your youth or consider your youth to be a disadvantage. We've been speaking for 10 minutes. You are 10 times smarter than people your senior. So never your youth is, whilst it may be a disadvantage in some elements, you are so smart. Please never consider your youth to be a disadvantage of you, because you have a future in whatever you decide. You are a very intelligent person. So never play down your youth.
Back to
what you were saying before.
No, thank you for that. I appreciate it. But yeah, I think with the other thing with small modular reactors, and this has become, and how you can just place it at the current locations. Well, first of all, you don't need as many locations for nuclear energy. And the reason for that is uranium, the fuel that goes behind nuclear energy, is incredibly dense. So you don't need all the land for the solar panels and the wind turbines. And that's caused a bit of a debate recently. And, you know, it's quite obvious why, you know, nuclear energy requires hundreds of times less land than those alternatives. And the final thing I would say is in regards to transmission, and this has become another debate quite recently. The advantage of nuclear energy is because it can really, there's not too many requirements for where you build a reactor. Because it can be built at, say, a coal-fired power station, the transmission infrastructure to connect the small modular reactor to the grid already exists, so you don't actually have to, you know, build this new grid that the government's doing, and that means less money needs to be spent, and it also ensures the protection of Indigenous communities, of our native flora and fauna, and on top of that, of course, our agricultural lands, which are threatened at the moment by these huge transmission infrastructure projects.
Yes, and I want to get into that, because I believe that's all part of this this renewable red herring that we're being sold, that we're not being given the full story. And we're also told that wind and solar is cheaper than say, nuclear. Now, I don't want anyone to think that I'm against renewables. As I said at the beginning, I'm all for a mix of...
I'm not either.
Yeah.
I'm not either. I think that nuclear complements renewables.
That's it. We need the base load power. But nuclear is definitely a great source of power because it essentially doesn't burn or do anything. But there is the issue of what it takes to build renewable. I haven't been able to find this information, and maybe I need to go to the relevant minister and ask this question. But when they say that, you know, I don't know if you know the answer to this. I hope you do, because I'm about to ask it. When they say that renewable is cheaper, do they factor in the cost of building the power lines, the infrastructure, the transmission infrastructure to support renewable energy? Because what we do know, and what I do know, is that according to the Australian Energy Market Operator, They believe that it's estimated to be about $383 billion to build this transmission infrastructure. That's just the power lines itself. But you've got other experts saying, well, no, it's actually five times greater than that. It's going to cost $1.3 trillion, which we all know that we as the, well, maybe not you because you probably still live with your parents, but we as in adults who live in homes and apartments and have electricity, it's going to cost us. We have to pay that $1.3 trillion. So we want
to. And the future generations, my generation will be burdened with that. So it's a huge concern also for me.
Yes.
I do have a number. Which people may have heard of. The Net Zero Australia report recently came out, and what they've estimated actually the cost of net zero to be is for $1.5 trillion for just for the end of the decade, to meet the government's targets. And by 2050, I think it is, net zero will cost $7 to $9 trillion. So I think when people say, oh, the wind and the sun, they're free, There's a bit more to it than that. And wind and solar are not free, and you talk about transmission and all the other things. And the government will regularly say, oh, nuclear energy is the most expensive form of power generation. And look, my opinion, and this is supported by many experts, is that's just simply not true, because they currently rely on a single report to make that claim, and it's called the GenCost report. And, you know, I came into this I looked at this report and I initially thought, oh, well, it must be this really complex computer simulation which factors in all of these Australian conditions to form this number for nuclear energy. But no, really what it does is it rips this data from this 8-year-old report, a 2015 report, global report, which has since been updated to show that nuclear energy is the most expensive form of power generation, which they don't actually factor in. And there's all these other issues where they don't factor in the proper storage costs. And because of that, look, when you look at that report at face value, yes, it might say that nuclear energy is the most expensive form of power generation. But in reality, it's quite clear that nuclear energy is not the most expensive. And that can be proven by reports and all of these studies done around the world. And people can look to those, including the International Energy Agency's recent one. But the evidence is really of nuclear energy in practice. Is nuclear energy in practice the most expensive form of power generation? And it simply isn't. There's a reason why France, which has a grid powered by 70% nuclear energy, has some of the lowest energy prices in the world. And you compare that to their neighbour Germany, where they've recently shut down all their nuclear reactors. They've actually had to go back to fossil fuels and coal because of that. But their energy prices are some of the most expensive in Europe. And, you know, people might say, oh, it's cherry picking. This is supported by the global evidence. There's other examples like in Ontario and Canada, etc. But the last example I'd bring you is in terms of the UAE. And they've recently, and they were much like Australia, they didn't have any nuclear energy. And in around 2010, they decided to build 4 nuclear reactors. And what they have done, they've now constructed 3 of the 4 of them. They've found that first of all, those four reactors will power 25% of their nation, but they'll actually provide power at 25% of the cost of gas. So the facts don't lie. Nuclear energy is not the most expensive form of power generation, and especially over time, the cost of generating electricity from nuclear is incredibly low. And in part, that's also due to the lifetime of a nuclear power plant. They can last for up to a century or something like that. You don't have to replace them as much as solar panels and wind turbines. So I don't think it's accurate to say that nuclear is the most expensive form of power generation. And that's really been holding back, I think, the debate at the moment. But it needs to be addressed,
yeah,
I think, for us to make any, have any traction on this issue.
Well, and I want to talk to you about the potential environmental risks and wastes of going renewable. But just to speak to what you were saying about nuclear energy being cheap, but also was it Germany who had to go back to who had to go back to coal fire because they tried to go green. That's happened in New South Wales. We've had to extend the life of the Eraring power because we've tried to jump to green energy too quick, and the experts have gone, oh, hold on, we can't close that down too soon because we're no longer there. So more evidence and even evidence in our own backyard. Now I do want to touch on there's so much I want to talk to you about, but let's just jump on. You've mentioned the lifespan of nuclear power. That is from what I understand, power plants can last decades. I think like 60 years plus, I think for the smaller
60
ones.
Years, 60 years plus, but theoretically they can last for up to a century.
That's it. Whereas wind turbines, was it 20 to 25 years from my understanding?
Yeah, and that's a similar number for solar panels as well.
But they're not recyclable from at the moment.
There's been some innovations in that, but certainly the current solar panels and wind turbines are not being recycled. And I think it was this year they found out a way to maybe recycle solar panels. But the fact remains that nuclear energy, it produces significantly less waste. It's the only form of energy which is actually able to manage its waste. Like you said, solar panels, the waste from renewables, that ends up in many cases in landfill or is burned in other nations. That's incredibly harmful, and it's of a much larger volume than nuclear waste. And then you compare it to the other one, which is fossil fuels, and where does that waste end up? Well, it ends up, we breathe it in every day because it ends up in our atmosphere, and that's got a permanent effect. That's the waste I'm concerned about. Now, if I might just describe it, how the nuclear waste, how that's managed, because I think it's a bit of a misconception. And it's certainly not stored in yellow barrels. So I'd make that clear. So there's really, I don't want to overcomplicate it, but there's three types of waste. It's very simple: low, intermediate, and high level waste. And that describes how radioactive it is. So Australia already safely manages low and intermediate level waste, and that's produced from the Lucas Heights facility. And that's needed if we're going to have treatments, if we want nuclear medicine to treat things like cancer and stuff. So Australia safely manages that, and that's, the radioactivity is incredibly low. That literally includes things like gloves that some of the workers wear that ends up in there. So we can manage that. The new thing is high-level waste, and that's the high radioactivity, highly radioactive waste. But to put into perspective, first of all, the volume of it is incredibly small. To all the, if you added up all the high-level waste in the world, it would easily fit in. An example close to your home is it would easily fit in the SCG.
Yep,
it's incredibly small volume. It can be safely managed. You can look it up on Google. People have hugged this waste. Even a pregnant lady. I saw an image of a pregnant lady hugging this waste, and she doesn't come out with mutations after doing that. And these days, it can be reprocessed using things called breeder reactors. So this waste, people don't even like using the word waste because it can be reprocessed, it can be recycled. It's really just spent fuel. And the thing is, I know it can be confusing, but high-level waste basically describes the spent fuel, so the fuel that comes out of the reactor.
Yep.
And we're going to have to inevitably deal with high-level waste as a result of AUKUS as well. So one way or another, we're going to have to be storing high-level waste. It's incredibly safe, like I said. We've got the expertise to be able to do it well. So I don't think it's an issue, and I'd encourage people to do some further reading on that as well.
And AUKUS is the nuclear subs that we'll be getting.
Yes.
Now, do you know of any country, especially a comparable country in size to Australia, who is successfully powering itself just by using wind and solar alone?
There's no major economy to the scale of Australia which has been able to successfully do it. That's what I'd say. In most cases, if you look at the countries who've been able to successfully transition, they've either had to use a large amount of hydro or nuclear energy, because both of them provide like a constant, reliable source of energy. So there's no major example. And the thing I'd say in regards to that is I don't think Australia should be the first to try and attempt it and to see if it pays off. There's already been issues so far, and you know, down the track, it could be, I think, quite, if it fails, it could be really quite disastrous. And certainly the impacts detrimentally my generation. So, you know, if you want to get to net zero, the proven way to do that is by using nuclear energy. And countries like France have been able to demonstrate that.
Yeah. Oh, look, your generation, this young generation, I don't think they're going to be able to handle not being able to be on TikTok or Snapchat when the lights go off because renewable energy can't keep the lights and the internet on. They're going to go, well, oh, crap, we went down the wrong path with that one. Oopsie daisy.
The shame in that as well is if they can't charge their phones, if they can't look at their phones, they won't be able to see any of our content from Nuclear for Australia on the social media pages, so they won't know of the solution. They won't be able to educate themselves. So it's a major dilemma.
It's a double-edged sword, really.
It is, yeah.
Now, let's talk nuclear. There is, you know, there's a lot of negativity towards it, and I'm sure through your research and your dealings online that you've come against those who have either ill-formed or even well-formed arguments to why nuclear is not the way to go. What are some of the things that people have come to you and said, and what have you said in return?
Okay, I think it's no surprise that I've received quite a significant amount of backlash, and you know, I'm not surprised to be very honest. It's on things like Twitter and TikTok, and sometimes that turns into personal attacks. The responses I usually get, look, it's overwhelming. Look, I get those attacks, but I think people are open to listening to.
They're not accepted.
Yeah, no, they're not. The stuff that's been said about me and my family is just, or I'd say, disgusting. Yeah. And it's not acceptable towards a 17-year-old either.
That's it. That's
like
it. You are, don't take this wrong, you're a child. You're not. You're a young adult. You're a young adult, but you're 17, you're a child. Just to get off topic and to get onto a different topic.
Yeah.
Too many people need to understand that. Okay, yes, you can disagree, but you have a respectful conversation and you use fact and evidence to back up your to have a conversation or a debate about a topic. To go emotionally,
and that's what I'm trying to do. I don't want to present this emotional case in nuclear energy. I understand I'm a 17-year-old, so my focus has been on sharing facts and information with people. And, you know, I even do live stream Q&As with experts where people can ask their questions, because I think that's really important that we have a fact-based debate. Back to your last question about what people have said. People always bring up the cost and time issue, and I've discussed that this evening with you. But there's unfortunately, I think nuclear energy, there's obviously a bit of misinformation in the past, that's been propagated through things like The Simpsons. And unfortunately, nuclear energy or civil nuclear power often gets conflated with, you know, the nuclear proliferation movement, and the people conflate it with, you know, the weapons testing that we had in Australia. And, you know, it creates, I think, quite a bit of anxiety.
Yeah.
And in those instances, well, I don't engage with people just full stop, really, on social media, because it doesn't end well from what I've found. And people are right to have really, to have strong opinions on those sort of things. But I'd just encourage them to, you know, come to nuclear energy and sort of ditch their old ways of thinking, come to it fresh and be willing to consider the arguments for and against it, and not get caught up with some of those emotional arguments, which go historically have been an issue.
Yep. This has to be taught in schools as well, just on a different topic.
True.
Okay, so true. Let's talk about the time and cost to build nuclear. That's the one that's been flagged mostly. You know, it costs too much and it'll take too long to build. How long will it take to build nuclear and what's the cost?
Okay. So in terms of the time, I'm not going to deny that to build a nuclear reactor and to build it well with the level of regulation we would expect in Australia, it takes time. There's been cases, say, in, I would go back to the example of the UAE. They were able to buy reactors off the shelf from South Korea and build them in a decade. And there's been, you know, estimates it might be a decade to 15 years. And that also, you need to factor in that Australia is new to civil nuclear power and we have to set up the legal frameworks and stuff for it. What I would say is, specifically in regards to time, and I'll address that first, is, you know, there's no time to waste. We should be, if the government was serious about climate action and addressing the energy crisis, then they would be lifting the nuclear energy ban today, setting up the frameworks so we can immediately start working and at least bring in the business cases and to at least look and consider the cost of nuclear energy. So if they do choose to approve a nuclear reactor, it can be built and it can be built in a reasonable time frame, because the thing is, like, fossil fuels will remain in our grid for decades to come. That's in the government's own plan, whether it's gas or whatever. There's always going to be a role for nuclear energy whenever it comes in. And the argument I would make is all options need to be on the table. Now, in regards to the cost, I did talk about this earlier. I just made this point, but I'll repeat it. But if we were serious about looking into the cost, I addressed that Gen Cost report and whatever. But if the government wants a true indication of the cost, they would legalise nuclear energy today. Because at that point, then the government could accept the business plans, and business plans could be submitted, proposals for nuclear reactors, which would demonstrate to the government the economic viability of the reactors. And at that point, the government, if it's too expensive, which I don't think it will be, but say if it is, the government doesn't have to approve a reactor. But if it proves to be economically viable, well, then they can, you know, sign it off and start constructing it, and it'll provide cheap power to Australia. So, and I think it would be likely that they would be able to do that, because nuclear energy, like I said, has been proven to be economically viable around the world.
Let's jump into the political side of this debate, the fun stuff. You wrote a letter to our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, urging him to lift the nuclear energy ban. Ben, what was your honest thoughts about his response? Well, not his response, because the Assistant Secretary of Energy Climate Branch wrote to you in response saying, and I quote, "In regards to nuclear energy, while the government does not support the current prohibition, does not support the current prohibition, it recognises the ongoing research to nuclear energy and related science more broadly. It's vital to informing public debate." Whatever he said, pretty much said that the government's not going to lift the ban. What was your honest thought to that non-response from the Prime Minister?
Look, I appreciate that the government's, you know, responding to a 17-year-old's letter. I think that's a good thing. It wasn't the Prime Minister, but I'm at least they responded. People can read the letter and the reply on the website that you're referring to. Yes. And I've got it in front of me now. But the government, basically, they said in the letter that the government reinstates that they aren't going to lift the nuclear energy ban. But as people would be able to see if they read the reply, they don't actually have a single reason for why they want to keep the nuclear energy ban in place. It's almost like, well, they've relied on the expectation that their current policy, that their targets are just going to work, and therefore it's nuclear is not needed. But as we know, that there's already been challenges facing their current targets. So, and if there is any risk of that, then they should have a backup. That's my point. The other interesting line, and this was the one after that excerpt you just read out, is, and I'll quote, in the letter it says, "The government also serves to reiterate the role that nuclear energy can play globally in the net zero transformation. And the point I'd make there is, you know, if they can acknowledge that nuclear energy has played a role in countries reaching net zero globally, nuclear energy has shown evidence to lower power bills, to lower emissions and increase energy security in countries around the world, and they acknowledge that, why couldn't nuclear energy have the same positive impacts here in Australia? And I think that represents a major contradiction in their current policy, that they're willing to acknowledge the fact that nuclear energy can be beneficial elsewhere. But apparently, even though we've got all the prerequisites for nuclear, whether it's the uranium, whether it's the sites, the expertise, apparently for some reason Australia wouldn't be able to do it. And that doesn't really stack up for me as a 17-year-old. It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't at all. And I hope your generation see that too, and also see through the blind trust that they have in just their policy alone. This is not the only topic that the Albanese Labor government has this blind trust in without even considering alternatives. It's our way or the highway sort of approach to topics that and issues that will affect not only us today but generations to come. I feel I see through it. I hope everyone else does too, but maybe it's because I live political life day in, day out. But since you've had a lot of attention with the media, and since this first letter, has Albo or even the energy minister contacted you?
No. And I've contacted both of them. Like, I sent a letter to Albo, and that response came back a month later, and I contacted Chris Bowen, the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, twice, once with the letter, and then a second time asking for a meeting, and I got a response quite late to that. I have no doubt that they've probably heard about me. They probably don't really like me, to be honest. But I had the opportunity recently on Q&A on ABC. They were doing a high school special, and I had the opportunity, and I encourage people to watch this as well. They can look it up on YouTube or iView. I had the opportunity to ask the minister for youth, Anne Ali, a question about nuclear energy, and I had a bit of a debate back and forth with her, which is quite the experience for a 17-year-old debating a Minister of State on live television. But I basically asked her, like, you know, the experts are saying that there is risk of this your government's plans failing. Like, what is the backup? What's the redundancy? What's the plan B if it does fail, besides from dirty and polluting fossil fuels for my generation? And look, she went back to the talking points and didn't really address it, she's very, very nice, the Minister for Youth, and I think she had the right intentions, and she was, yeah, she's very nice and supportive to me. Obviously, it's not very politically convenient that I exist and I'm doing what I'm doing for her government, so at least to show me the respect and to just be, I guess, nice and generous with me is something that I appreciate. And hopefully the government can, you know, look beyond their current policies and listen to some of the people like me who are screaming out for nuclear energy to be on the table. And hopefully there'll be a point in time where they do realise that they need to look beyond their current proposals and possibly consider the prospect of nuclear energy.
Well, look, it's not her portfolio, so it's understandable to why she's just speaking the talking points. But I watched that and I found it a little bit patronising on her behalf towards you, as if, you know, there, you're just a young boy, what would you know, sort of attitude. But something I find hilarious with politicians is they get their daily talking points. We all know that. That's how the sausage is made in Canberra. But I don't know if you've ever noticed, I implore you to keep an eye on it. You know that they're reading out their talking points that they get emailed. because they have a cheesy grin every time they repeat them. So I saw that on her face when she was talking the lines, and it's like, oh, you're just proud of yourself for reading the talking points of the day. But anyway, that's a different story. I'm disappointed that the Albanese Labor government are not taking you seriously with what you're doing. Let's talk the other side of politics. Are you happy that the Liberal Party is shifting their attitude towards nuclear, and have any of their politicians reached out to speak to you?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that they have, but I make it really clear to your audience, I'm not a member of the Liberal Party, like some people on Twitter may suggest I am. And I'm very vocal, and I have been in the media in condemning what the Liberal Party did. Look, this is a John Howard era policy, to be very honest, the nuclear energy prohibition.
Yes.
It occurred under his watch.
Yes.
So John Howard has reconsidered his position on that, and obviously that was a political trade-off for the GST. But the Liberals have not been very good when it comes to nuclear energy, and, you know, they've contributed to the situation we are in now. And there was a decade where they weren't willing to consider, well, there's some people like Ted O'Brien who were, but they weren't considering even lifting the ban on nuclear energy, and I think that's to everyone's detriment and to the detriment of my generation. But in regards to their recent announcement, I think it's a step forward, and it's a good position that they've been able to come to. And I just hope that there can be some level of bipartisanship, and, you know, other politicians can also advocate for nuclear energy. I know this is taboo and everything, but it should be a bipartisan issue, and it is around the world. Like, the Democrats in the US support nuclear energy. Biden recently invested quite a bit into it. The Great Britain, the Labour Party there supports nuclear. Even the Finnish Greens Party. The Greens Party in Finland support nuclear energy. So it doesn't have to be this political issue. It was never meant to be a conservative or liberal party issue. I don't get why people think it is, because, you know, you're advocating for it's a solution to climate change, which, you know, if politics wasn't involved, if anything, the Greens Party should be advocating for this. And I don't get why they're not at the moment. But hopefully we'll see some action, and hopefully politicians will forget the political colours and the colours that they're wearing, and consider the science and consider the arguments for nuclear energy to be legalised.
William, if there was a way to convince not only politicians, left and right, far off in between, generations old and young, of taking nuclear as a solution to our, not only our baseload power alternative, but as a way of getting this country to net zero, because I don't think anyone disagrees that we need a baseload power and we need to look after the environment and preferably go net zero. What's your message to people to get them over the line?
This is a good question.
I will point out we have been speaking for 40 minutes and you are probably exhausted by now, and here I am at the very end throwing this hard one at you.
I think my message would be that we should have all options on the table as we deal with this energy and climate crisis. And if we want to have a chance of reaching net zero, then we need nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, unlike fossil fuels, is both clean and safe, and unlike renewables, is reliable and a proven solution. And for those reasons, I think it's a solution that Australia should consider. And certainly, at very least, we should look to legalise it so we can then do the investigations to understand whether it would make sense to construct a civil nuclear power reactor here in Australia.
William Shackle, you are indeed a unique and fascinating person. I could speak to you for hours, because I feel as though we've barely scratched the surface on this topic. I think we've only just covered pretty much the things that are being spoken about at length and at nauseam in the media at the moment. And I know this is a deeper topic, a topic that we're both passionate about. And I think that not only the Shire of which we broadcast, but the state, the country, the globe needs to talk about more. I do hope we get to speak again soon, because I feel like this is going to be a topic that will not go away. And I also feel like, as I said before, you are going to have a future where you appear in the media often, hopefully in politics one day, because you talk about you spoke about the politicians, but even those of those politicians who you've spoken to, I feel as though you are way smarter than a lot of them who are running this country, Will, even at 17.
That's a bit generous. That's a bit generous. And the final thing I'd say is, you know, if people are interested in what I was doing, I'd encourage them to look at my social media pages, Nuclear for Australia, look at the website, nuclearforaustralia.com. And if they support what I'm advocating for, the ban on nuclear energy to be lifted, I'd encourage them to sign our petition at nuclearforaustralia.com/petition.
I love it. William Shatnell, thank you so much for joining us on the Troy Murphy Show tonight.
Thank you, Troy.
Never miss a show. Listen on demand. Click the Troy Murphy Show on the 2SSR.com.au homepage program guide.